Shoes.
Recorded live.
Hello, is anyone there? Hello, is anyone there? Hello, is anyone there?
Hello, everybody. This is Rick, and this is the AR, Fair Recovery, Q&A for October the 10th, 2011. I'm going to get my act here together in a second. So the first question is on forgetting. I've truly forgiven my spouse, and I'm healing and becoming whole again. Things are going as well as possible in my marriage. My triggers are mostly gone. Some days I feel joy, and I'm at peace and feel content. And at times, I do still remember the pain of the betrayal. Is it humanly possible to forget this pain and to shed it once and for all to be free? What does the Bible say about forgetting? What do you know about forgetting from your professional experience? Any light that you could shed on this would be appreciated. Thank you, Rick. I think that forgetting really has a lot to do with time. I don't know that anyone truly ever forgets, but in terms of those triggers coming back and painful memories, I know that Stephanie reported after probably 3 years that she just didn't think of it anymore. And it wasn't that there might not be something that would remind us, but it didn't carry any pain. And to me, getting to that place of an extraordinary life where you really live from this thing, that does happen. The one thing you didn't put in here was how far out you are. But I find that most people, if they're still thinking about it and it's still carrying a lot of pain for them after about 3 years, I probably have a little bit of concern about how they're moving forward. It seems like there may be something in the way. But in terms of the Bible talking about forgetting, as far as I know, only God is able to throw things as far as the east is from the west and truly forget. So I think that we forgive and at times we remember. But that remembrance doesn't always have to be a thing of pain. Hopefully it's transformed and it becomes, that remembrance becomes more of an Ebenezer stone, a place of remembering ultimately and seeing what God has done. And it becomes a point of celebration, not a point of disappointment. And I would hope and pray that you'll come to that point. And again, if it's still a problem after 3 years, then I would begin to wonder if somehow the two of you have something that's you haven't fully recommitted and been able to move forward. So use that 3-year mark as a place maybe of determining whether or not there's still a problem, but it sounds like you're headed on the right path. So I do wish you well in that journey, and I hope most certainly that you continue to heal. Next question here is understanding actions. Rick, I'm the hurt spouse. We've attended EMS, Harboring Hope, Hope for Healing. And while I'm clearly seeing God's work in myself, my husband, and in our marriage, I'm struggling with the ownership of his actions. First discovery, December 2009. Full discovery wasn't until June 2011. After receiving full discovery, I'm trying to gather a clear and mutual understanding of his actions and behaviors. I believe he has had an addiction, while he does not agree with this. I've read books, Torn Asunder, Winning the Battle Within. You mentioned addiction at EMS. He fits it. I can live with addiction, but I can't live with him not deciding are not looking at what it is. I have a deep need for both of us to have a clear understanding. I've shared my thoughts with him and asked him to help me research addiction so we would both have a clear definition. He agreed, but is yet to research and talk about it. Any thoughts and guidance that you can give me? I would hope in a situation like that that maybe the two of you, maybe we could even have a call. I'd love to talk with y'all. I think that finding the time together to get on the same page is absolutely critical. It's interesting, the newsletter this week is about acceptance and how one of the biggest barriers to recovery is your mate not accepting things. And it sounds like you're both kind of moving forward and making good progress, but you do need to get on the same page. I would bring the topic up. You could have him listen to this answer. If anything else, if y'all have questions, again, I would gladly talk with you about it. You could also post another question next week. If the two of you could maybe pose some questions, looking in your EMS workbook at the definitions of sexual addiction, even better, here are the definitions. A persistent or preoccupation or craving sex. It can also be a behavior or a person wanting to cut down but unsuccessfully attempting to limit the sexual activity, frequently engaging in more sex and with more partners than intended, thinking of sex to be the determinant of other activities or to the detriment of other activities, or continually engaging in excessive sexual practices despite a desire to stop, neglecting obligations such as work, school, or family in the pursuit of sex, continually engaging in sexual behavior despite negative consequences such as broken relationship or potential health risk, feeling irritable when unable to engage in the desired behavior, escalating scope or frequency of that activity to achieve the desired effects such as more frequent visits to prostitutes or more sex partners, and if a person has three or more of those symptoms, he or she is likely to be dealing with an addiction. So I don't know exactly, not knowing your situation, what was going on. If it was a limerence situation, potentially you might want to look at it differently. But I do encourage both of you to continue pressing forward till you come to an understanding of what it is, because it's going to be difficult for you to feel safe going forward if you're not able to agree on what this thing is that you're dealing with, and for both of you to feel comfortable knowing that you're addressing whatever it is appropriately so that y'all can move forward in the future without having to deal with this again. So the next question, is there an advantage to getting help soon after discovery or disclosure? If so, would you explain why? Yeah, the primary reason that I feel like getting help sooner rather than later is it allows you to begin addressing the situation before you begin to really wound one another in that healing or in that process. A lot of times, until you get on a path, there is the hurt spouse is working so hard at trying to get the unfaithful spouse to get it, the offender to get it, and in that sense, it kind of drives a wedge in the relationship. Oftentimes, the unfaithful spouse is being defensive, which leaves the hurt spouse feeling uncared for. So the longer you wait to begin to get on the same page and working together, I think the more chance there is for wounds to be created, more distance. When you can both get on the same page and feel like you're moving forward and you're creating a safe crucible for the two of you to begin to work and explore this thing where you both feel safe enough in this relationship, that is really, really helpful. The longer you wait to get there, the more junk you've got that was created not only because of the infidelity, but because of the unproductive interactions that were occurring from the point of disclosure. A great example, I think, was this weekend. There was a couple, and they were about 2 months. In fact, both couples were about 2 months post-disclosure. But one couple in particular, he still, in that two-month period, because they weren't really working together, had not done full disclosure, which was meaning that it was harder for them to even really hit the starting line, partially because he needed to figure out how to tell her everything and she needed to know what to do with it. And when you can get to that place, you're going to find that it's going to be very helpful. Next question. Will a hurt spouse heal if they just try to get over it? If they count on time alone healing their wounds, what will be the outcome? And I believe that the outcome is not nearly as hopeful. In fact, I know that only 54% of couples that talk about this very little actually even survive, while 86% or 87% do really well when they're able to discuss it and process it. The problem with stuffing everything down ultimately is that it comes out about 5 years later. And either in physical illness or just a lack of desire for your mate or continued anger, but it's difficult for couples to really reconnect. Our goal at A Fair Recovery is for people to have an extraordinary life and to really grow as a result of this and use it as a catalyst to achieve and accomplish something in that relationship they never experienced before. That doesn't happen from a position of just getting over it, largely because the hurt spouse is going to feel unimportant, and it's just the steps that couples go through to heal. It doesn't happen, and for that person, it may be or feel really impossible to be comfortable really making themselves vulnerable to that person once again. So I don't think it's a good idea just to let time alone. One of the things that our time alone heal their wounds, one of the things Leslie says, and I think it's really good, is that it's not a matter of time that, you know, heals the wound. It's what you do with the time. And I think that's a really important concept. How you use that time is what's ultimately going to bring about healing. Now, if you've got somebody who isn't going to do anything, can you heal? Yes. Grief and working through all of that and being with other women and processing, or men, other people who are like you where you can go through that, that's great. But if you heal individually but you don't heal as a couple, I mean, I don't know in the question I just saw that, will they heal if you just try to get over it? Yeah, you can heal, but I don't know whether the marriage could ever be ultimately as, connected, as healed as I hope that extraordinary marriage that you're looking for. So I hope that's not a case of what you're trying to do and that you can find hope in this process and healing. Final question for today, disclosure to friends. Can you comment on providing advice or how to handle close friends? They know we're going through marriage counseling, but they don't know the details, although they know it's something serious. They're probing, but we don't want to disclose an affair to anyone. How can we handle this and similar inquiries about what we're going through? Great question. I think it's really important to be careful about who you do disclose things to. At the same time, when you sit there talking about how we can handle this and similar inquiries, and we don't want to disclose an affair to anyone, I would suggest that you want to find 2 to 3 people that you both agree upon to disclose the affair to, only because you really finding people who can support you in this process is terribly important. You almost need them as a stabilizing force, if nothing else, through Harboring Hope, through EMS Online, EMS, here in Austin. But find other couples that you can talk to that have been through this. That is going to be really an important piece. Now, when other couples that you don't want to disclose things with, I would just, when they probe, sit there and just tell them, thank you for asking. And, this is just a difficult time for the two of us, and we're handling it. Just pray for us. But I would not feel any obligation to disclose what it is to them. I would just tell them, thank you for being concerned and to please pray for you, but you are addressing it. And I don't know if they continue to probe, sit there again and say, you know, really, we're dealing with this as we think we need to, and please respect our boundaries here. We've both decided how we want to go about this, and we appreciate your concern, but we're not going to talk about the details at this point. And I just think you've got to draw a very clear boundary with them. You can do that in love, again, thanking them for their concern, but let them know that you're taking care of it, you've got support, and you know, at this point, y'all decided that you're not going to be sharing the details. You're keeping it between the two of you. I just think you tell them straight out. But like I said at the very beginning, do find other people that you can talk to. If they don't feel safe, then find other people who are safe. We all need safe people to talk to. And healed individuals are vital guides as you go through this process. And I would highly encourage you, strongly encourage you, to find other healed individuals who can be a part of your journey. Next question, and let's see. What is going on if an unfaithful spouse who is a sex addict stops engaging and acting out? Does it goes to meetings sporadically, has a sponsor, but doesn't really tell him what's going on, and becomes angrier by the day, all the while contending he's not angry? So typically, this is what I would call a dry drunk. And it's a place where somebody's white-knuckling, really trying hard not to act out. And at the same time, they're struggling because it's really painful to stop the behavior and try to control it. And in the attempt to control it, ultimately somebody becomes more and more frustrated and angrier and angrier. There are two terms that they use in recovery, which are clean and sober. Clean means that you're not acting out. Sober means that you're living a balanced life, full of peace, full of abundance, that you know, you're in recovery, and you're living almost under a new system. A lot of times what people will do is they'll try to white-knuckle and control the behavior. What recovery teaches you is to release control in order to gain control. It's about focusing on something different. It's what we call a second-order change. A first-order change is what, like playing baseball. It's trying to learn to play baseball better. A second-order change is you stop playing baseball and you begin to play soccer. It seems like what you're describing is more of somebody who's still trying to do better at baseball, but it's very difficult. And in that situation, that what you say where they won't even admit that they're angry, that's denial. And that denial actually is, they don't even see it probably at this point. They just know that they feel a certain irritation. And the fact that they are angry, the one good sign I can tell you from that is it probably means that they're not acting out, because that's what the dry drunk does. Because they're not drinking, you know, they just become more and more irritable. At least when I worked with alcoholics, I'm not saying this for your mate. Sometimes I'd say, look, you either need to get in recovery or drink, because it drives me crazy. But, you know, because I really, for someone like that, they're miserable, and I certainly would hope that they would try to get help. Another alternative, if they don't want to do something like a 12-step group, and they're not going to really be talking to their sponsor, come to the Hope for Healing group. Because that gives an alternative that puts them in a different way of seeing it, and also gives them a really good support group that they are in contact with every day, because that's one of our goals, is keeping people really well connected. And that should be able to help.
Hello? Was this recorded? There's someone there. This is Mariana. I guess this is recorded. Hello?
Now our last question for the day. Boundaries. I know boundaries are good, But what do I do if my spouse does not respect them? I can't make him. That's exactly right. But if you go back to the newsletter that was released last week, I guess it would have been on about October 6th, boundaries also, it's not just telling somebody, it's not just a request, it's also laying out what the boundary is and in some ways what your response is going to be as a result of their, I mean, how you're going to protect yourself as a result of that boundary if they're unwilling to respect the boundary. It actually has your actions, you know, of what you're going to do. If they do this, then you're going to do this. So they already know the consequence associated with the boundary. And I think that when you get to the place of setting boundaries, remember that boundaries aren't about trying to change your mate or control or manipulate your mate. Your boundaries are about your own self-protection, and it's about the choices. You're very clear. It's about the choices that you need to make if they're not able, if you're not able to come to a place where they can also keep you safe. I like to use the analogy of someone stepping on your foot. If they, you tell them to please stop stepping on your foot, if they continue to step on your foot, you're obviously at some point going to move your foot because you don't want to get your foot stepped on. And so that would be the action. You'd say, if you don't stop this, I'm going to have to remove myself if you just keep stepping on my foot or whatever. That's probably a silly analogy. But the boundary is, it needs to have a consequence at least associated with it or an action so that they know what's going to occur if they do this. And then you need to have the self-respect to at least follow through with what you say. Threats really aren't what we want to use. We want, and remember, it's always, even boundaries, always say love acts in the best interest of another person. So boundaries are in their best interest, and they're in your best interest. Sometimes, you know, you might tell your mate, it's just not okay to treat someone like this, which is why I'm doing this. But I'm doing that for your, because I care about you, not because I'm angry at you. It just feels to me, if you can do it in love, and they know that it's not out of a reaction, but it's really something that you're thinking about, and you're considering them, then that goes a long way to helping out. So that's the end of our calls today, finally. I certainly want to thank everybody for writing in, and I hope you guys have a great week to healing.
Thank you.
Is anyone still on the call? Hello?
Call's over.